Good morning. Hello there. Welcome to Collett House and to this day on evolving consciousness, which I hope will become clearer and clearer both internally and externally as the day unfolds. I'm Mark Vernon, and we're going to kick off very shortly with the first conversation between myself and Gary Lachman here. But first of all, just a couple of announcements which you may have gathered already. The first and most important thing is that we had two of our speakers had to pull out in the week, Jules Cashford Ursula King. Sorry, I'm settling myself now. Ursula King and Jules Cashford, they became ill. They're fine, I think, but they became ill, so couldn't make it. But I'm truly delighted that we've got two brilliant speakers to replace them, actually, with expertise in their own right, which will redeem and add to the day as well. And that's Jessica Kingsley and Marilyn Monk. You'll see in what you've been handed, I hope, biogs of Jessica and Marilyn, and see that they are going to contribute something tremendous to the day still. Very grateful to them. We're going to keep introductions to a minimum during the course of the day, but you'll see their biogs, and then also the flyer which advertised the day. You'll see full biogs of people in that. So do scan down if you want to know more about people who are speaking. The second flyer which you've been given this morning has the program on the front, and I hope that starts to explain the format of the day. We're trying to do something a bit different. One of the big themes of evolving consciousness, taking a lead from figures like Owen Barfield, who is in a way our spiritual guide for the day, is the theme of participation. And so we're hoping that this is going to feel increasingly participative throughout the day. Broadly, the idea is that this morning we try and really pin down, get a deeper understanding of what this notion is about, evolving consciousness in this sense, this non-Darwinian sense, the sense more about what it is to be human, how we relate to ourselves, nature, cosmos, the gods, the divine. Really try and understand that. And then this afternoon, after lunch, there's going to be a chance to experience that in your body. And then also, the reason why we've got these round tables is in the second part of the afternoon to have discussions in smaller groups to really try and tease this out for yourself. There's a bit about what that involves on the program, so I won't say more now. We'll say more at lunchtime, obviously, before we finish with the dialogue between David Lorimer and Rick Tarnas. When you go downstairs, you'll see there's coffee, and that's where lunch will be as well. Lunch, tout compris, today. But if you could refrain from talking, particularly in the little corridor bit by the door, because there is another group downstairs doing something as well, so that'll avoid us disturbing them too much. I hope you found the toilets in the basement. Up here, Collett House requests no drinks other than water. It's because they try and take care of this floor, and the whirling dervishes notice it when the door has had something spilt across it, other than polish. So just water up here. And there is water actually in urns outside the door there, as well as the refreshments down in the basement. I particularly wanted to thank myself, the Scientific and Medical Network, for helping us with this day. It's been very much a collaboration since I proposed trying to do something around the theme of Owen Barfield and related figures. But particularly at this moment, I wanted to thank the Fetzer Institute, who have very generously funded us today and enabled the really good price of the tickets we were able to offer, including lunch, which I hope makes it as open and available to people as possible. If you don't know the Fetzer Institute, please do take a look at the leaflet that we've given you, but also their website. Because as I fairly recently discovered myself, just in the last year or so, what they're doing in the US is deeply commensurate with what we're trying to do here today. This idea of spiritual formation, participation, developing who we can be into the 21st century. There are an endowment set up by John Fetzer, who was a significant spiritual explorer in his own right in the 20th century, and they fund both events such as this, but also interventions in schools, in prisons, trying to foster particularly democracy in the US, a whole range of enterprises that try and nurture and encourage who we can be as human beings. So please do have a look at FETSA, because you'll find things which will be of interest, as well as just knowing of their generosity in supporting today. I think that's all right for the announcements for now and is clear. And I want to get going because it's already 10:15. Now, as I mentioned, we're using Owen Barfield's ideas to kind of get us going today. And I hope that in this first session, myself and Gary will begin with what he was trying to show us, and then show how that's connected to other figures as well. But really, in this first session, the idea is to try and get as clear as you can in your minds what this notion of the evolution of consciousness is about, participation, meaning, and so on, where we're at now, the meaning of today and the alienation of today. Then after the break, our four experts will develop that in their own ways to help tease out even further. And before, as I say, after lunch, there's the chance to really explore these things for yourself more directly, by both in the embodied ways and in discussion. But let me turn now to Gary. I think we can sort of begin the content of the day. Gary, now you met Owen Barfield.
Yes,
so tell us something about that. It'd be good to bring him in the room with someone who has met
Hello?
Him.
Hello? Yeah. Sorry, this is a bit low here. But yeah, I met Owen Barfield in early 1996 when I first moved to London from Los Angeles. And I'd become aware of him, I became aware of him because I was having difficulty trying to understand Rudolf Steiner, and I'm sure that's not an uncommon experience. And I read, there was an anthology edited by Robert McDermott, who was from Baruch University, but was also one of the leading lights at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And it was an interesting anthology of Steiner's writings. And in the introduction, he mentioned Owen Barfield, and he said that he was one of the Inklings and a friend of Tolkien, a friend of Lewis, and things of that sort. So that struck me as interesting. And then when I found Barfield, he was much more readable than Steiner, which is not to diminish Steiner, but Barfield's had quite a grasp of the English language. And so I read quite a bit of him, and then when I was here, in the first few months I was living here, there used to be, I don't know if it still exists, but there was a little Steiner bookshop over on, I think it was High Holborn. It was called the Wellspring Bookshop. And I was in there, and they had quite a few of Barfield's books, and I was looking at them, and the fellow running the place said, well, he likes visitors, you know. And I didn't know that, so I was pleased to learn it. And he told me where Barfield was, up in Forest Row, East Grinstead. And he gave me a phone number to call. So being enterprising, a young 40-year-old something, I gave him a call, and he invited me out to visit him. So this must have been February or March 1996, and I think it was the last interview. I don't know for sure, but that's the impression I get. And oddly enough, in a way, I had met him in a different way months earlier, when I was still living in Los Angeles. And I forget how I got involved with this, but there was a professor of English at University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, G.B. Tennyson. And he was a big promoter of Barfield's works, and he edited or brought together some of reissues of his books. But he was working on a video, a documentary of Barfield. And somehow I got involved transcribing about 20 hours worth of videotape of interview with Barfield. So I spent about a week, several hours a day, listening over and over, trying to get exactly what he was saying. I mean, the documentary is up on YouTube. It's a half hour. So after about, somewhere between 15 and 20 hours worth of videotape, I boiled it down to a half hour. So I sort of felt I knew him or had met him. And then when I actually did meet him, it was wonderful. He was brilliant, very sharp, witted. I suspect was 97 or 98 at the time. And he was staying in a sort of, not exactly a care home, but it was, he was living in a sort of an estate where he was taken care of and things of that sort, because he was, elderly. But one of the things I said to him was that I don't usually see too many, 97-year-old people. And he said, oh, really? I meet them every day. So he was very clever. And I just found, I mean, he's quite humble, Barfield, about his own contribution to this notion of an evolution of consciousness. And he says that he was working on it before he became introduced to Steiner's work. If you know Barfield's books, his very first, well, nonfiction book, History in English Language, History in English Words, is about the evolution of consciousness through the study of language. And then he said, well, I was doing this on the small scale, and then when I became aware of Rudolf Steiner's work, it was a much larger operation that he was doing. That may be the case, but I was more convinced, and I found more of a way into this particular way of understanding the evolution of consciousness through Barfield's writing than I had through Steiner's, because, again, not to diminish Steiner, but you don't have to get over the hurdles of sort of Lemuria and Atlantis and various sort of root races and things of that sort, sort of the Blavatskian theosophical inheritance that Steiner had. Because if you follow Barfield's argument through the study of language, you will see that it makes sense that there is this, or there's evidence for a kind of evolution that's taken place.
So let me jump in there and see whether my understanding of these sort of key terms resonates with yours, and let's see if we can sort of begin to nail this down. Consciousness, first of all. This is not about the hard problem. If you thought today is going to be another step towards solving how meat generates mind, as it's sometimes rather gruesomely put, that's not today. We are assuming that our most immediate experience, awareness, consciousness, is the most sure thing we can rely on. What consciousness means, therefore, in this context, is our perception, how we experience what it is to be human, what we see, what we don't see, both with our senses, but also with the mind's eye. So it's all that. It's the nature of consciousness. Evolution doesn't mean Darwinian evolution. We're not talking about how consciousness might have arose or emerged, emanated even over the millennia of our species, but rather how it shifted more recently in cultural time. And particularly, it's over the last 3,000 years or so. And the reason why that's such a good period is because, as Gary just mentioned there, words were the key bit of evidence for Barfield that he worked on. And he realized that words don't just transmit meaning now. You know, you're not just hearing acoustic vibrations coming across the airwaves. You're actually hearing meaning as I speak, I hope. It's that which is most immediate to us. But if that's true now, Barfield realized, then words that have changed meaning over time can become what he called fossils of consciousness. And if you can track back how meaning has changed over that time, then you can track back how consciousness has changed too. And what he realized when he did this was it wasn't just that people had different ideas or insights or thoughts, but the very nature of thinking, the very way of receiving insights from the world around had itself changed too. And this is really the key notion, I think, and this is what this notion of participation means. It means that the way that we engage actively or passively with each other and the world around us, it's not just developed in a kind of linear sense, but the means by which we do it has changed so interestingly as well. So let me just give you a couple of examples that I hope flesh that out, and Gary, and then I'll pass back to you. If you read, say, Homer, or if you read, say, the earliest bits of the Hebrew Bible or other ancient traditions, maybe even if you look to indigenous peoples today, who still, I think, carry this older consciousness, they may well, say, use myth much more than theory. They may well tell stories that somehow keep them, give them a sense of direction through what feels like a sort of flow of meaning within which life is embedded, rather than, say, our approach, which is to come up with a theory, say, a proposition, an idea, which we feel exists more or less inside us, that we then, as it were, step back into the world to try and test out, to try and see whether it's true or not. So rather than, as it were, having maybe a whole panoply of myths, maybe a whole pantheon of gods, that people previously would have turned to navigate, say, their way through autumn or winter, spring, summer, for a period of life, depending on where they were, through a rite of passage in life, and use that to navigate this sense of way through life. We tend to look for, well, ideally even one theory that kind of sums it all. that can capture everything that we then sort of test into the world. And I quite often feel that a good way of summarizing it is that Barfield realized that where consciousness before was experienced from the outside in, we now tend to experience it from the inside out. And this leads me to the sort of second big idea, I think, that's in Barfield, and then he found in Steiner, and I think you can find in other figures as well, which is that the individual matters more to us today, in the sense that we regard it as the kind of primary site of, say, our development, of progress, of almost sovereignty, you might say. You know, there is probably as many women in this room as there are men, because we value the individual, rather than, say, in this older consciousness, which Barfield called original participation, where your social status sort of showed the place in society where you could flourish. So justice back then, for example, meant a harmonious society where everyone was living to their fullest humanity, but in their place in the cosmos, in the divine order. Whereas now for us, justice means how you as an individual can exercise not only your rights, but can become all that you might be able to become as an individual, which in principle is as much and the same as everybody else around you. So the individual matters. In terms of the divine, this also, I think, was key to the understanding of monotheism and the understanding of, particularly of the significance that Christianity played in this evolution of consciousness. Because what Barfield argued, and I think this is true for Steiner in his way as well, that whereas, say, in the earliest parts of the Hebrew Bible, and certainly in the ancient Greek world, pantheism, many gods, was the natural way of experiencing the world around you, because you experienced yourself as related to this kind of scattering of spiritual beings, of entities, of vitalities round and about that you drew into yourself to find a life. We now experience ourselves, at least in principle, as kind of gathered wholes, having a kind of integrity and a oneness of ourself. And so, certainly in the Hebrew tradition, this old, difficult to understand perception that Yahweh might be I am comes to be realized in the reflection and the echo of your own I am-ness, that you can see, catch a glimpse of the divine oneness, the divine I am-ness. And so one of the key steps in the evolution of consciousness in this 3,000-year period was the emergence of monotheism in the Jewish tradition that became Christianity, that became Judaism as we understand it, and in fact has had quite a big influence upon religiosity, spiritual traditions around the world as well. So that's the kind of Christian bit, why Barfield saw the position of Jesus and the emergence of Christianity is a kind of pivotal point. He talked about being a kind of turning of the tide, where this oneness gathered to such a point that individuals could start to realize that, first of all, a person who had lived, who transmitted the divine, and that could become our calling too. Our most fully flourishing moment for us as human beings too would be to know the divine oneness as well. Gary, does that make sense to you in terms of your understanding?
Well, I know that for Steiner, Christ's incarnation and then what he calls the mystery of Golgotha, which was the crucifixion, was sort of the center, the most important event in human history, so far at least. But I have to say, my own approach to Barfield and to Steiner was to kind of, how should I say, not necessarily Christ-free, but it wasn't sort of the way I got into it. And before I go on, I just want to say something that, on a personal note, I'm quite thrilled and honored to be here because in a book I wrote called Secret History of Consciousness, in which I talk about Barfield's ideas in the context of other philosophers of consciousness, one of the people I talk about in there was P.D. Uspensky, who in the 1930s and 40s held his talks and groups here. You might have noticed the blue plaque outside on the building. So on a personal note, I feel kind of chuffed, as they say, to be in the same space that Uspensky was in. And he probably would have thought, I'm sure he didn't have much good to say about Steiner, so I suspect he wouldn't have had too much good to say about Barfield either. But, I mean, the notion of a kind of group consciousness or more I don't want to use the word racial, but Steiner used that, and Barfield used that as well, a kind of consciousness in which the individual was not as important or didn't play as important a role. This is something that I could see happening in the shift from this original participation in which we're embedded. We're embedded in nature then. We're embedded in the world. Where we don't have the sense of separation from it, which we enjoy or languish in today, depending on when you're feeling it. And this was something that I thought was very key, because one of the issues with, I mean, we recognize that there's something wrong with human consciousness. There's something wrong with our consciousness. We're not particularly happy. We have a vague sense that things aren't quite right, and it's got something to do with our being separated from the rest of nature, something to do with being separated from the rest of the world. And in a general broad sense, in the alternative or mystical or spiritual community, this is seen as kind of a bad thing. This is the fall. You know, we've fallen from this earlier state of unity, of connectedness, of being part of the great surround. And it's sort of a negative thing that we found ourselves here kind of alienated. But Barfield and Steiner and the other people that I wrote about in my book, with Barfield, people like the German-Swiss philosopher Jean Gebser, or the maverick French alchemist and Egyptologist R.A. Schwalla-Dulubich, the British writer Colin Wilson. Yes, this sense of kind of separateness or detachment or alienation. It's kind of a period of growth, let's say. It's sort of something we have to get through to be able to get to what Barfield called final participation, which would be something, he talks about it in the context of reading poetry. This is how it kind of came to him. He talks about how the same sort of shift in consciousness that he experienced in reading poetry, and the poetry that he's talking about are the romantic poets, people like Keats and Shelley and Blake and Wordsworth, who are the lyrical poets. What they're talking about is the soul. They're talking about the inner world. And this had got lost in the modern age. The kind of sudden shift or break or change in consciousness that he experienced when he was reading these poets, he got from reading ancient language as well. And the difference there was where the poets are sort of going out of their way. They're trying to make this effect. They're using language in order to create this effect, to kind of break the barrier between inner and outer. And when you have that poetic moment, it's a mini mystical experience. The separation between you and the outer world, ego and the non-ego, is dissolved briefly. And you, as Blake said, you can see heaven in a wild flower, or you know, the world in a grain of sand, and things of that sort. And it's something that we experience when we're children, and we grow out of. Necessarily, so I would say, in order to deal with the world, because the world is a difficult place. If every time we, everything we saw was infinite, we wouldn't get much done. You know, we'd be kind of stuck, just completely gobsmacked by, you know, the mystery of existence itself. So it seemed to be a necessary evolutionary change in order to take ourselves out of that. But we, you know, with the apron strings cut, we found ourselves adrift in the cosmos. I mean, the American novelist Walker Percy had a book called Lost in the Cosmos, and I think it's a good kind of summing up of where we find ourselves. But this is we talk about evolution of consciousness. We have arrived at this place. We have come to this place through a process. The consciousness we feel today is not consciousness per se. And what Barfield discovered in poetry, but also ancient language, was a kind of consciousness that seemed to not experience this detachment, not experience this separation from inner and outer. The language suggested that that wasn't the case. And this suggested to him that, at an earlier time, the kind of participatory consciousness, in the sense that inner and outer are not separate, but there's a continuum, that the poets and, you know, mystics talk about, and which today, you know, we can experience if we ingest certain substances or meditate or something like that. This was something that was common, let us say. It's radically new for us, but it was common back in an earlier time. But they didn't possess the individual ego consciousness that we have now. So it's like, okay, you can have the separate ego consciousness where you feel free and you're able to make decisions, but you're completely detached from the rest of the cosmos and you're lost in the world. Or you can be embedded in consciousness, in the world, and feel that closeness and that connection, but you don't have the individual sense of self, and you can make your own decisions, and you have free will. So neither of those seem to be a good answer. But what Barfield discovered through his reading of poetry was that there seem to be times when you have both at the same time. And this, out of this, he develops his notions of polarity and things of that sort. So I would say that, I mean, I know both in Barfield and Steiner, the sort of Christ event is the Christ's incarnation and crucifixion is sort of he talks about kind of a V-shape movement. And, we start up here, metaphorically, closer to the cosmos, closer to the spiritual world and the divine and all that. Gradually, through a process of crystallization or hardening, we lose that connection, but we're gaining the individual ego. But then at the bottom of the V, that's like the worst, that's it, the dark night of the soul, as it were. But then with for Steiner and for Barfield, Christ's incarnation and crucifixion is the beginning of the upward movement back towards the spiritual realms, but with retaining our ego consciousness. And this would be something that I would say most spiritual practices aim at in some way, although there are some schools that say, no, we just got to get rid of the ego completely and plunge back into the one. But I don't think it's understandable that some schools would think in that way, but I don't think that's the way that Barfield thought we should go, or Steiner, or any of the really important spiritual thinkers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very helpful point, I think, because it's one of the reasons why Barfield very much started making sense to me, is that you can read older spiritual texts where the return to the oneness and with a kind of dissolution of self seems to be the goal, maybe a deep dreamless sleep, these kind of metaphors are used. But I think that with this evolution idea, you get a sense of how the alienation of today, which you described there, itself has meaning and is part of this process. Because what we're invited into in the future is a freedom where both we have our sense of being individuals, but as it were, our microcosm reflects the macrocosm once more. The many return to the one, but without losing the individuality of the many. This is both, as it were, the task and the mystery, which you see echoed across very many traditions. Now, you mentioned Coleridge there, and maybe just to add a little bit about the imagination, which you have written about and I have as well, because it feels to me this is one of the key faculties that we have now. Imagination itself is a word that has a history. It did not mean the same thing that it means in the modern world as it did, say, if you read imagination in Epicurus. Now, what it means is that we are, if you like, kind of fantasy-generating individuals, people. We're constantly, rather than, as it were, receiving the stream of insights and impressions and presences from the outside, we experience them now as emerging from within us. And what people like Barfield, drawing a lot on Coleridge, actually, in the Romantic tradition, realized is that a lot of these fantasies that come from within us are maybe fun, but they're a bit chaotic and they don't really add up to much. They don't really take us anywhere. But every so often, one of these fantasies really lives. And if we can stay with it, if we can sort of follow its energy and its spirit without trying to reduce it too much too quickly, it takes us into a whole new world. This is what Barfield discovered when he read poetry. It's what Coleridge referred to when he said that our imagination proper, this creative part of ourselves, this expansive part of ourselves that lives and grows, is but an echo of the divine imagination which runs through all of creation. And with people like William Blake as well, he felt that is what creativity is, in fact. It's kind of like the divine imagination emanating and exploring, extending the world. We too are called to be part of that. And so in terms of spiritual practice, one of the things which I feel, say psychotherapy, which is one of my own practices, I work as a psychotherapist, can get onto, is how our fantasies aren't just illuminating about our inner lives, in dreams, say, in synchronicities, in maybe even unusual experiences. But when we can stay with them, we realize that they're but echoes of the inner life of the whole world, as Barfield put it rather beautifully. And so our imagination is one of our key kind of faculties that we need to learn. It's not just, as it were, adding color to the world, Which I think is how C.S. Lewis rather sold it. We hadn't quite mentioned the Inklings yet, but another really important part of Barfield's life was his relationship with both C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Both Lewis and Tolkien broadly said that Barfield had the best ideas. They had the genius ability with writing, and so are now wildly well-known throughout the world. But Barfield was really key that this imaginative writing that they were so good at wasn't just allegorizing meaning, wasn't just, as it were, maybe amplifying what rational thought can pin down, but was itself part of the experience, part of the knowledge, and in particular was the way that we grow into this return to what was called original participation, but he referred to as final participation. By final, he didn't mean the end point. What he meant was it's the teleological point to which we're moving, the kind of the heuristic goal, as it were, to know both ourselves ritually and fully as individual souls, but realizing that our egos had become in the service, you might say, of the wider self, as Jung called it, or as the divine I am, as would maybe be more the Judeo-Christian way of putting it. The imagination is so key here. And I think, you know, in science, we're going to develop this, I hope, after the break and with the scientists on our panels. But it's in that romantic tradition of science which realizes that the intuitions that then get developed into the hard science come from an immersion in the world, be that by literally traveling the world, as figures like Humboldt realized when they developed the notion of ecology, or by imaginative thought exercises, as Einstein realized when he thought about traveling on a light beam that led to the science of relativity. Personal development, it's about, I think, not this how do I sort of get over my ego, but in a way, how do I go into the ego more and more and more to discern how it can open up into the service of the wider whole so that a realignment takes place within myself. I think, you know, spiritual experience is often about that now. Sometimes it happens rather dramatically, and then people work out what that realignment might be and call it waking up or enlightenment. Sometimes it's a steady, slow process, as was the case much more in my own experience through the bitter years, the hard struggle years of psychoanalysis in the more Jungian tradition. What it means for our society is very, very pressing now, of course, with the ecological crisis. And broadly speaking, I think it's going to mean something like realigning our sense of growth so that it's not just about material growth, which is the accumulation, you might say, of more and more and more, and the development of technology, which has its own blessing, its own great benefits, but is going to be realizing there's another kind of growth that material and technological growth itself can be in the service of, which is about rediscovering the depths of reality, about awakening ourselves even to not just forces in nature, you might say, but the spiritual reality of nature once more, the inside of the whole world, and the intelligence within which our own intelligence rests and can capture an echo. So that's something a bit about, you know, what this move from the now, the meaning of the now, towards something different might be about. Again, any further thoughts there?
Well, I mean, imagination was key for Barfield and Coleridge and Blake and, you know, many others as well. And one of the things that I do in where I've written about Barfield is that I said I line him up with some other thinkers, and there's something that they share in the sense that we think of imagination as fantasy and coming up with a substitute for reality, or in a utilitarian sense, being on the cutting edge, being, you know, innovative and, you know, getting ahead of your competitors in the market and things of that sort. And of course, we still have a place for it in the arts and all that sort of thing. But as Mark said, I mean, for Barfield and for the other people we've been talking about, imagination is key. It's central. We wouldn't be seeing this room we're in now were it not for imagination. Not in the sense that we're making it unreal, but it's a formative power. It informs what we're seeing. If we were just left to just the sensory perceptions of things out here in the room, it wouldn't make any sense. We wouldn't know what any of the things were. They wouldn't be things. They would be sense data in this kind of, you know, very fundamental sense. They become things in the sense that our imaginative power, which is a creative power, forms them, turns them into recognizable shapes and forms and objects that actually again, we just look at it blankly. It's not even a chair. It's a chair because you bring your imagination to it. You know what a chair is. It's your idea of what a chair is. And it's a chair because it shares many other, shares all the qualities that chairs have and other chairs have them as well and things of that sort. But the other aspect, I'm saying there's two things I would say about imagination is that it's basically a way of getting to the inside of things. Rational ego consciousness deals with the outside of things. And again, rightly so. The world is a difficult, dangerous place. You only need to know. We reduce our experience to just enough to be able to deal with it. I mean, I talk about the distinction, very simple, thumbnail way of looking at it, between sort of survival consciousness and appreciative consciousness. So there's a survival consciousness. When you're walking down the street and you see this large body hurtling towards you down the road, you don't need to know the make and model or the color of the car. You just need to know to get out of the way of it. Just as if you're in the jungle and there's a large being over there, some shape moving towards you, and it's making a loud noise. You don't have time to marvel at the stripes on the tiger and things of that sort. You just need to get out of its way. Once you've got out of its way and you're safe and all that, then you can turn around and say, "Oh, what a lovely, that's a Mercedes 1966 or whatever it is, something like that." You can take in all the irrelevant information from a purely practical utilitarian survival aspect. We need both. I mean, someone who's brought this up and rebooted a great many of these questions in a scientific context is E. McGilchrist. I don't know if you know his book Master and His Emissary, where he reboots the whole left brain, right brain story, which had got kind of sidelined for quite some time. And I talk about McGilchrist's work in the context of Barfield because Barfield's talking about participation. It's very much, it seems to me, along the lines of what McGilchrist is saying, how the right brain engages with the world. And the difference he makes is that what he and other neuroscientists discovered, it isn't so much what each brain does. They seem to be doing the same sorts of things, but it's how they do them. And the left brain is very precise. It's very good at narrowing down to detail, and it gets finer and finer, sharper and sharper, sharper, more precise detail at the expense of the connection to the larger whole. The right brain presents a global, total picture, but it's fuzzy. It's not as detailed. The right brain sees the forest, the left brain sees the trees, it sees the individual leaf on the tree, it sees the individual veins in the leaf, it sees the individual cells making up the veins in the leaf, finer and finer and finer in detail. We need this, it's absolutely necessary, but we gain that at the loss of the connection, much like the ego. We become more and more conscious of ourselves as separate individual egos, but we lose the sense of connectedness. We gain the sense of connectedness at the expense of having that kind of sense of ego. But the thing, imagination for Barfield is a way of seeing into the inside of things. And this is something that the French philosopher Henri Bergson talked about in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, intuition. I mentioned Shuala Dulubich. He's the fellow who's first said that the Sphinx was much older than the official account because the erosion marks on it are from water, not from sand and wind. So it must have been there quite some time ago when there was a lot of rain in Egypt, which hasn't been the case for some time. But he talked about something called the intelligence of the heart. And this was something that he believed the ancient Egyptians knew and understood, and their whole religious pantheon is based on this. And again, it was a way of being able to understand the inside of something. And someone who took this idea very seriously and was a major influence on Rudolf Steiner was the German poet, scientist, novelist, statesman, Goethe. Goethe developed a whole scientific approach using the imagination. He wrote a book, The Metamorphosis of Plants, where he devoted this kind of loving attentiveness to the study of plants. And he claimed that he was able to perceive something that he called the Urpflanze, which is the primal plant. It's a kind of archetypal plant that it's not sensory. You can't see it with the senses, and it's not just a concept. It inhabits this intermediary realm that the French phenomenologist and student of Persian mysticism, Henri Corbin, would later call the imaginal. It's not the imaginary, which is the fantasy, which is the substitute for reality, but the imaginal is a realm in between the physical and the purely conceptual. It's a realm of images. That's the realm of poetry. That's the realm of the imagination. Mark was talking about these fantasies that come up in our consciousness at times, and these are images. Jung would say they're emerging from, well, your personal unconscious, but also your collective unconscious. And they tell us something about the world. They have a real cognitive content. And this relates to the other thing I wanted to say about imagination, which is as if it is the case that for the last 300, 400 years, we've sidelined the imagination in favor of this more precise, rational, logical, scientific, you know, material, you know, however you want to characterize it, way of dealing with the world. It isn't the answer to that, or what should we say, you know, what we need to do to correct that imbalance isn't just to plunge into the imagination itself. I mean, Barfield was really concerned about that. I mean, in a book of his called Saving the Appearances, that came out in the late 50s. Because Barfield believed there was a real relationship between what goes on here and what happens outside. I mean, one of the strangest things Steiner ever said, that the way the world will appear in the future depends on what people are thinking now, which suggests that the way the world appears now is a result of how people thought sometime before us. And this goes completely against, you know, our modern rational thinking, because this is just like there's a little blob of consciousness in my head, in your head, in your head, and it doesn't get outside of our skull. But what Barfield and Steinerman and these others say is, like, unlike Vegas, what happens in the mind doesn't stay there. It actually goes out into the world, and it affects the world in some way. And this is, you know, we talk about this in a pop kind of trivial way about create your own reality and things of that sort, which is based in something true, but I think a lot of its use today is rather shallow, and it's a kind of trivial way. But it's based on a fundamental true idea. Our inner world is intimately connected with this outer world out there. We've lost the sense of that in these moments of participation through, you know, meditation or poetry or anything that does it. We have a brief feeling of there's a continuum between the two. And the next step is to realize, oh, well, what happens here takes precedent. What happens here, after some time, will affect the world in the out there. So it's very important what we imagine. It isn't just plunging into any kind of, you know, imagination, let's go. Just let the imagination go and let it rip, and it'll be better. And this was sort of, some of the romantics believe that at different times in history, a book I wrote about the 1960s, it was something like that too, the sort of 60s counterculture, sort of the rejection of the scientific, materialist, reductive world. They said, but let the imagination rip. Let the unconscious rip. Let it just go. And Barfield was concerned that at the time, the sort of art that he was aware of and was being produced suggested that the imagination was delving into some rather dark kinds of places. He was concerned about surrealism and things of that sort. And I would think today, I mean, you might read what he says and think, oh my God, he was hysterical, he was an alarmist and all that. But I don't know. If you look around at the art I see these days, I don't see it's got much better than when it was when Barfield was writing, he was concerned. So it's very important what we actually imagine. It's not any old imagination will do. And this is a distinction Coleridge makes as well. It's really important. The difference between what he calls true imagination and fancy or fantasy. And a simple distinction is, with fancy or fantasy, you take things that are already made and you put them together in strange ways. So you put some wings on pigs. You have flying pigs. You don't see them. They're a product of imagination. But they're not truly original or truly creative, because you're taking stuff that's already been made and just putting it together in a strange combination. Whereas for Coleridge, for Blake, and the others, the product of true imagination, it may not seem original or novel in the kind of sense that we want to see things novel, but it's truly original because it goes back to the origin. It's an echo and a product of the origin, which is this true imagination, which for Blake, for Coleridge, for Barfield, so many of the others we're talking about here, is at the root of the phenomenal world. I mean, you have to turn it around completely. I mean, we tend to think in the modern world, imagination is just something that we kind of tack on to make life a little bit, you know, better, to make it a little more bearable. Whereas they're saying, no, it's at the fundamental bottom of everything, at the root. It's the foundation of it. And we have to understand that. And if we can understand that in our individual lives, we can enliven not only ourselves, but the actual world. I mean, this is part... The redemption is not just of ourselves, it's redeeming the world as well. And we Obviously, we need to do that in real practical, physical terms, in terms of the ecology and the environment. But there's another way we can do it, through how we envision the world, how we actually perceive the world. And Blake would say, as you see, so it becomes. You know, as you see the world, so it will become that. So it's very important that we, you know, sort of have an idea of the power behind the imagination.
Thank you very much. I mean, I'm going to draw this first session to a close. Sort of on that note, that it matters very much what we think, what we imagine, and just interject the notion of struggle, because that's another key part of it. Well, maybe I should invoke the more Sufi word, since we're in this room, used very regularly by Sufis, of bewilderment, that this is a crucial part of the emergence of a true spiritual imagination. And this room is full of individual minds connected to one another, struggling perhaps with these ideas, wondering what they realize. One resource which we've given to help this struggle, to help navigate through this bewilderment, is a glossary of terms on the inside of the program, which I hope will help this sort of first session of really trying to get some grip on what we're talking about. You're also surrounded in these lovely round tables by many people with many different experiences. Some have written about Barfield, some have made films about Barfield, and one person is related to Barfield, because we have Owen Barfield's grandson here as well today, and other people that know about different traditions as well. So please, in the breaks, do make the effort to say hello, because that's very much part of the day, which we're hoping to facilitate. When we come back after the break, we're going to have a panel of four people with a different take on all these things. And that, too, is really crucial, the difference, because, as Gary mentioned there, this notion of polarity is absolutely crucial to the emergence of a true imagination. What Coleridge described as the tension between different points of view that don't just get stuck in a kind of dyaded combat to the death, a zero-sum game, which so often characterizes our world now. But as Jung put it, to draw another thinker who's quite related here, creates what he called a transcendent function, where the two can emerge into a third, and something completely new emerges from the meeting of the imaginations of the both. And so I hope very much that as we move into the second phase of today, that might even start to unfold in our experience. As you listen to the panel of the four, where their different takes on these things, it meets your minds, it meets your discussions, and something starts to emerge from this basis, but that perhaps you didn't even quite expect might be sort of shown to you as our participation in life, maybe even today, grows that little bit more. So I'm going to call things to a pause now. I'm going to say thank you very much to Gary for helping us to put down these kind of foundational ideas. I'm going to say that we're pushing against the clock already. We have got time, actually, but this is a short break. If you wanted to go downstairs and use the toilets, please do that speedily and get yourself back up here. There's water just outside the doors in copper urns, if that's a good enough refreshment, but there's also coffee and biscuits downstairs. Remembering about the quietness downstairs as well. We've got a bookshop downstairs selling my book, selling some of Gary's books, selling books by Owen Barfield. Malcolm Guite's books will be there too. I hope that the buying of those books will be straightforward, but we're trying to work on that with Andrew, who's working here today. But thanks very much for this first session. I hope you're excited. I hope your imagination is stirring.
Thank you.
Is the coffee also right downstairs in the refectory?
Yeah.